Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present syndicated columnist and author Norman Solomon, who examines the media coverage of recent disclosures that the Bush administration had been warned about possible terror attacks prior to the September 11th assaults on New York and Washington. Larry Burns, with the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who analyzes President Bush's hardline policy toward Cuba, announced after former President Carter's recent visit to the island nation. And Matt Bivens, former editor at the Moscow Times, who takes a critical look at the nuclear weapons reduction treaty that President Bush and Vladimir Putin will sign May 24th. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Angola's grueling 27-year-long civil war ended with the battlefield death of UNITA leader Jonas Savimbi in late February. His rebel army quickly fell apart, and the Angolan army announced a halt to offensive military actions and imposed a formal ceasefire in early April. The U.S. government first backed Savimbi and his rightist UNITA movement in 1975 to counter a leftist independence movement that later took over the Angolan government. By the 1980s, the U.S. and apartheid-era South Africa pumped money and personnel into Savimbi's military machine. Over 500,000 Angolans died and 4 million have been displaced by Savimbi's U.S.-backed war. Although the nation has substantial oil reserves and other resources, it remains mired in poverty and has the second highest infant mortality rate in the world. The Nation magazine says the Bush administration now has responsibility to aid in Angola's social reconstruction. At the moment, Angola earns $3 billion a year through oil exports, although a significant part is lost through alleged corruption and complex deals between Western petroleum companies and Angola's economic elite. The people of Angola are now looking forward to peace and the reconstruction of their nation. The U.S., which once funded the destruction of schools and health clinics, should now, according to The Nation, contribute the funds to rebuild them. As a young boy, Cambodian writer Phan Anna had the unpleasant experience of finding the decaying remains of his father and uncle. They were killed by the Khmer Rouge in the late 1970s, and the bodies were dumped in a compost pile. By the time Anna discovered the bodies, they had badly decomposed. Quickly, the family collected the bones and old clothing and cremated them in a Buddhist ceremony. Now, a generation later, Anna is still seeking justice, but he is frustrated that top Khmer Rouge leaders still walk freely in the country. In early February, talks between the United Nations and the Cambodian government broke down over initiating a war crimes tribunal. The UN claimed the government could not provide a fair trial to those accused of wrongdoing. Soon afterwards, a top Khmer Rouge commander, Ki Park, who human rights monitors say is responsible for thousands of deaths, died. Many former Khmer Rouge brass still live freely in the Cambodian countryside. Overall, 1.7 million people are estimated to have died during the reign of the Khmer Rouge from disease, starvation, and execution. Some Western diplomats blame the UN for the collapse of the proposed war crimes tribunal. They say that UN lawyers who accused the Cambodian government of stalling never came to the country to close the deal. An insider lamented, "The UN was asked to come and it refused." Meanwhile, thousands of victims like Phan Anna must now continue to wait for justice. Last summer, a patient at the Hope Clinic for Women in Granite City, Illinois, was rushed to a local hospital because of complications following an abortion. A group of anti-abortion protesters was waiting outside and took a photograph of her. Only days later, the photo and a copy of her medical records were posted on the Missionaries for the Unborn website. According to Mother Jones magazine, posting on the web of photos of women who seek abortions is the latest harassment tactic used by militant anti-abortion activists. This began in the spring of 2001 when a federal appeals court ruled that the First Amendment protected the infamous Nuremberg Files website that lists names and addresses of abortion providers and puts a line through names of doctors who were killed. The Nuremberg Files creator, Neil Horsley, created a new website, Abortion Cam, that features photos of women whom Horsley labels homicidal mothers. The photos are taken by conservative activists lurking outside abortion clinics. Now, the Hope Clinic and the patient have gone to state court in Illinois, accusing abortion protesters of invading their privacy. This is the first lawsuit of this type in the country. Meanwhile, photos of female patients coming out of clinics in 23 states are still posted on the Abortion Cam site. Horsley urges his ardent followers to just point and click. He is expanding his Abortion Cam projects to new clinics every week. He also has plans for a cable television show that uses video shot outside abortion clinics. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
Revelations that the White House received warnings from the FBI and CIA in August 2001 about possible hijackings and attacks being planned by Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network have motivated some politicians on Capitol Hill to call for an independent inquiry. After the explosive leaks captured headlines on TV networks and newspapers, Vice President Dick Cheney and others from the administration questioned the patriotism of those who are asking for an investigation into possible failures of U.S. intelligence agencies. Cheney warned that new terrorist attacks were imminent and wartime conditions demanded unchallenged secrecy. After 8 months of promoting patriotism, the media, for the first time since the September 11th attacks, have begun asking tough questions about the Bush administration's honesty and conduct in the months prior to the assault on New York and Washington. But some in the media have risen to echo the warnings issued by Dick Cheney, asking the press and the public to back off and place their trust in those occupying the White House. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with syndicated columnist and author Norman Solomon, who examines the way in which the media has covered the 9/11 warnings that came to President Bush and the culture of secrecy that has characterized the White House dealings with many issues, including the Enron scandal.
As soon as this scandal broke after the night of May 15th, when there was a CBS report, Ari Fleischer in the White House immediately said that it was awful and terrible and unspeakable that anyone would raise these sorts of issues. And I think it became clear very quickly that that wasn't going to wash, that for the first time, Democrats in Congress since 9/11 were willing to take on Bush in some major and potentially very substantive way. And so over the weekend, there was a shift into counterattack as part of damage control, you know, because the more defensive modes of damage control clearly hadn't worked. So you had Dick Cheney and other people in the administration not only firing back at their critics, but also announcing with a lot of drum rolls that the U.S. is under danger now from a future, perhaps even imminent, al-Qaeda attack in the United States that could be horrific and could be even worse than 9/11. And now we're hearing about the possibility of suicide bombings. And one of the notable things about this kind of effort to change the subject being engaged in by the administration is that there's nothing in particular to indicate why it should be announced and proclaimed now rather than 2 weeks ago or 2 weeks from now, because there's no particular time frame attached to it. So Cheney, while he's rushed to try to change the subject in the last 48 hours or so as we speak, he's gone ahead and done that while saying that what he is concerned might happen in the future in terms of terrorism in the U.S. could happen weeks or months or even years from now. So I think that's pretty transparent. In a weird kind of way that may not first be readily apparent, the Bush administration wants to raise a very high threshold as to what would indicate culpability on the part of the president and the administration. And I believe at this point, the Bush people would like nothing more than to have the question be whether Bush consciously chose to allow something like 9/11 to happen, because if they can have that framed as the measure or the benchmark of culpability, then I think it's pretty evident there's no evidence to support that. And so the bar is raised so high, by what I would say are the undocumentable charges by really fringe people who have been making such charges for many months, that it's exactly the sort of thing that the Bush administration would thrive on.
Now, one of the other things we've been hearing is that the United States is currently at war, and it's not the time for public hearings. It's not the time for questioning of Bush administration policies and dealing with the threat of terrorism, and that any questioning in the end could jeopardize the safety of every man, woman, and child in the United States. Now, that raises the bar quite a bit for politicians and reporters who are asking the tough questions. Do you think the media is responding appropriately to this threat, this implicit threat from the White House?
The damage control operatives out of the White House are trying to use the patriotism argument to basically tell people, sit down and shut up and don't raise any questions. I mean, they want to turn the First Amendment into kind of a first half amendment, which means, you know, that we should listen to the free speech rights of the people in the administration. And I think one of the dynamics that has shifted is that a lot of Democrats in Congress, for the first time since September 11th, have been willing to raise some important issues around September 11th events that the White House doesn't want them to raise. And I think we could extrapolate from this a general paradigm that does exist, and that is, when you have no division within or between the Democratic and Republican parties on a substantive issue, generally the mass media don't see an issue worth discussing in a major way. And for better or worse, and I think it's almost always for the worse, when you do have some kind of split or division between or among the two major parties, it's then and only then that the major media outlets say, hey, this is a major issue. We can really go to town on this. And I think that's the situation we're in now. One of the things that concerns me is that the editorials in places like the New York Times and the Washington Post in the last few days, since this big story broke, these editorials have been very much inclined to downplay the significance. There's a lot of vibe coming from the pundits and the big editorial writers of major newspapers to the effect of, hey, you know, don't get too excited. Let's keep this, take a deep breath. Let's keep this in perspective. And frankly, it's beginning to remind me of a lot of what we heard during the early stages of the Iran-Contra scandal, where there was clearly, according to astute observers, strong indications of outright mendacity in high places in the Reagan administration. But we had these pundits and major newspapers telling us, you know, in effect, we don't want a failed presidency. We don't want to get carried away and push too much against this administration. And I think it's incumbent upon people at the grassroots to make clear that we're not going to accept that sort of attitude.
That was syndicated columnist and author Norman Solomon. Read his Media Beat column online at www.fair.org. On Cuban Independence Day, May 20th, President George W. Bush gave his Initiative for a New Cuba speech that reinforced his hardline policy against Cuba. Bush's stated policy is in sharp contrast to Jimmy Carter's call to normalize U.S. trade and travel with the island nation. Bush gave a policy address before Miami's Cuban American National Foundation, an audience comprised mostly of wealthy Cuban exiles, where he denounced the Castro regime. With Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs Otto Reich at his side, he announced that the U.S. would intensify its economic and political isolation of Cuba by maintaining the existing travel ban and trade embargo. He also stated his administration would provide increased aid to political dissidents on the island and new U.S.-produced anti-Castro TV and radio broadcasts. However, critics charge that Bush's policy seeks to maintain political support in Florida's hardline Cuban-American community, which helped secure his victory in the 2000 presidential election and will assist his brother Jeb's re-election for governor in November. Larry Burns is the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs based in Washington, D.C. He spoke with Between the Lines' Denise Manzari about what he says is an auctioning off of U.S.-Cuba policy in exchange for financial political support from the right-wing anti-Castro constituency in Miami.
The Bush speech was a mindless, low-grade speechwriter's effort. I mean, clearly, it was a dumbing-down speech made by the president. Anyone who knows the history of the Bush family knows that human rights isn't a strong suit for them. After all, Jeb Bush was a major Contra leader, helping to fund an organization whose massive human rights violations are only now beginning to be told. There's always been this kind of selective indignation that, for example, Guatemala is right now going through a period where increased political violence and human rights workers have been killed and so forth. You don't expect the Bush administration to come out with a word about what's going on with in Guatemala. It uses human rights as a weapon against Castro. Throughout the relationship between Cuba and the United States, there has been a shifting playing field, and the goalpost has constantly been moved. For example, at one point, during the Carter presidency, it was said, leave Africa, get out of Africa, and then we can get around to start discussing normalization. Well, the Cubans left Africa, pulled out all their troops from Africa, and there was no discussion.
George Bush basically stated that Fidel Castro is a tyrant, his people are hungry, they're under the thumb of a dictatorial power, and they need to be freed and released from this oppression to join the ranks of the rest of the Western Hemisphere.
Well, I would answer it by saying that George Bush doesn't really have strong credentials in this area. He just can't pick and choose when it comes to human rights violations. Cuba is, in terms of human rights violations, is a babe in arms compared to China. A babe in arms. There may be 200 political prisoners, maybe 250 political prisoners. At one point, there were thousands. Under Carter, Cuba released large numbers of people. Bush's father, George Bush, on a trip as vice president to Pittsburgh at the beginning of the Reagan era, described Castro as the worst human rights violator in history. That kind of rubbish became the state of the arts with that administration. You can't say that there's much intellectual dignity in that kind of position. You can be sure that during the period of Pinochet rule, George Bush Sr. never had a word to say about it. The really important insight that one can generate on this is 99% of policymakers say that the way to accelerate democratization and improve the human rights situation there is constructive engagement.
George Bush personally thanked Dan Burton for being there on May 20th, Dan Burton being the co-author along with Jesse Helms from North Carolina of the Helms-Burton bill. He also thanked Ileana Ross Lettinen and Lincoln Diaz-Balart, two hardliner Republicans from Miami.
I've debated those people on a number of occasions. They simply are fanatics. Diaz-Balart's father was president of the Cuban Senate under Batista. He was a total collaborator with Batista. The Diaz-Balarts are not particularly famous for their commitment to democracy. There wasn't much democracy in Cuba when those folks were around.
President Carter spoke with the Proyecto Varela people, which is a dissident group within Cuba. But the Cuban government also has what they call the Felix Varela Center. Obviously, on both sides of the political fence. Do you want to talk a little bit, Larry Burns, about what you know about Project Varela?
Bush's proposal to provide even more funds to Cubans than were provided under the terms of the Helms-Burton legislation and were provided by the National Endowment for Democracy, backdoor financing, this discredits dissent. Most of these dissidents publicly came out and said, we don't want U.S. money. So what does Bush do? He offers more money. Now, this money, it goes into the hands of these organizations in Washington who are using taxpayer funds. I mean, he wouldn't allow taxpayers' funds to be used for Cuba to get food shipments and medical shipments. But when it comes to these organizations that are the best financed organizations in Washington, and they're playing a very negative role, by any means they have attempted to make their personal passion, irrespective of whether it's good for the U.S. national interest or not, the passion of the country.
That was Larry Burns, director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, a nonprofit think tank based in Washington, D.C. For more information, call area code 202-216-9261 or visit their website at www.coha.org. The nuclear weapons reduction treaty that will be signed in Moscow by Presidents Bush and Putin on May 24th has been billed by some in the administration as an official end to the Cold War. The agreement will reduce the number of deployed strategic nuclear weapons on both sides by two-thirds over the next decade, cutting the current number of missiles of between 5 and 6,000 to levels between 1,700 and 2,200. But the treaty also allows each side to store, rather than destroy, deactivated weapons, permitting them to be reactivated on short notice. This agreement is being signed as the Bush administration moves forward with its plan to build an anti-missile defense system, necessitating a U.S. pullout from the ABM treaty, while the White House proposes developing new low-yield battlefield nuclear weapons. The Pentagon is also getting ready to increase its spending by more than $30 billion over the next 5 years to upgrade U.S. nuclear weapons programs. Arms control advocates cautioned that while reductions of nuclear weapons are all to the good, this treaty misses an historic opportunity to make dramatic cuts in both nations' arsenals and lead the world's other current and future nuclear powers toward effective disarmament. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Matt Bivens, former editor at the Moscow Times and the Nation magazine's online Failsafe Point columnist, who takes a critical look at this latest nuclear weapons reduction treaty and the continuing dangers posed by Russia's loose nuclear weapons and both sides' tactical weapons not addressed in the agreement.
In reality, there are far more nuclear weapons that aren't being discussed in this treaty. There's no discussion of tactical nuclear weapons. Most of the tactical nuclear weapons are just as powerful as the strategic, but they're just not on missiles. They're designed to be portable. On the Russian side, there are many that are designed to be artillery shells or bridge-destroying weapons, to be used by combat ground troops in case of an all-out war. Between these and weapons the Russians have stockpiled, there are thousands and thousands more weapons that aren't being discussed. Russia probably has about 4,000 tactical nuclear weapons and maybe another 13,000 in storage. So this is sort of the big 800-pound gorilla in the living room that no one's talking about with this treaty.
The element of this treaty which allows either side to reactivate weapons that they dismantle at a moment's notice, it seems, and that the numbers of missiles could go right back up very quickly.
Well, that's right. Each side can reactivate pretty quickly if they want to, and this is something the Bush administration insisted on. They wanted to be able to pull out of the treaty quickly. They wanted to be able to store instead of destroy weapons that are being removed from missiles. And it's really questionable whether that's such a great idea, because it doesn't add anything to anybody's security to add new weapons to the hedge that we already have on both sides. And in fact, it arguably makes us less secure, because Russia has problems with its economy and with law and order that are pretty terrifying. The idea of them storing more nuclear materials when they do a terrible job keeping eye on what they already have, it's just not in our interest. The Russians have created a mini Afghanistan in Chechnya with carpet bombing and wilding of their troops down there. And the Chechen rebels are friendly with al-Qaeda, and they're experts at gaming the Russians and the corrupt side of Russian society. And now you're going to store thousands of warheads in places where security is really questionable. But that's sort of the spirit of this whole agreement. The agreement is, in fact, only in effect for one 24-hour period 10 years from now. December 31st, 2012 is the only date when we check and see whether we're in compliance with this treaty. And we look around and say, yes, we are. We both have under 2,200 strategic missiles and untold, unstudied thousands more of tactical weapons. Congratulations. And the next day the treaty expires. So it's not quite clear what we're trying to do with this.
In the end, is this an historic a treaty or something that would have occurred anyway by default in terms of the priorities and economic problems on each side?
Well, I think it's a historic missed opportunity. And if, God forbid, there's some sort of nuclear terrorist attack ever using weapons out of the Soviet arsenal, I think this moment ought to be remembered as the moment when we didn't do nearly enough. We haven't done nearly enough for the whole 10 years. You know, President Bill Clinton has just as poor a record in this area as anybody. But this is a moment when President Putin, Vladimir Putin, has made a very public choice to support the West, support the Bush campaign's fight against international terrorism. And he would have accepted just about anything we requested. In fact, that's what's happened. He has taken everything we asked for, and he's giving President Bush the triumph of a treaty signing for a treaty that does nothing. You're right, the Russians were going to go down to about 1,500 anyway because they don't see the point, and it's too expensive for them. This helps President Putin a little bit as a face save that he sort of got us on board. We are under no such economic pressure, at least none that we acknowledge, to reduce our arsenal. But we could have gone down to whatever we wanted. We could have gone down to 200 weapons on a side, 100 on land and 100 at sea, and that would have been a credible deterrent. And we could have gotten involved in a treaty that would have each side report how many tactical weapons they have, what they plan to do with them, what the thinking is behind them, how they're guarded. We have no information about that. It's amazing, but in 2002, we have no idea how many nuclear weapons we have on either side. And we could have done some sort of a deal where we got in there to start tying down Russian uranium and plutonium, which is poorly guarded, and started disposing of Russian chemical and biological weapons. You know, this was a moment we should have embraced, and instead, it's going to be a quickie PR photo op, and we'll get right back to Washington and forget about it.
That was Matt Bivens, The Nation magazine's online fail-safe point columnist. Read his column on The Nation's website at www.thenation.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Top. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Denise Manzari, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.